Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
My friend, criminal defense attorney Loretta Powers joins us again on the Disruption Zone. We always enjoy having the great and lovely Loretta. How are you? You see her on Fox News and hear her on Fox News Radio all the time. What's going on, Loretta?
Not much. Just living the dream. My husband is at the office. I work at home. So for me, it's perfect.
Sweet. Well, you live in Texas. So there's still a little bit of an outbreak there, right? So you
sure.
can use that as an excuse.
Exactly. Well, Texas kind of made itself the sacrificial guinea pig and right. opened up everything way too soon just to see what happened. And now we're seeing what happened, a spike in cases. So.
Yeah. Well, I still think the whole cautious. Thing's kind of overblown. I think what we're seeing now is that the virus is not as dangerous as a lot of people made it seem in the media early on. You know, and yeah, it's still out there and it's going to be around. I think what I'm worried about is the potential. This doesn't have anything to do with what we're going to talk about today, but I'm more concerned about the potential for it to sort of mutate, because it seems like I was listening to a podcast the other day, and it seems like there's some elements of this that appear to be man-made, meaning not that somebody created it on purpose and released it on the world, but that rather there was maybe some research being done on the virus that sort of quickly adapted it to humans, and then it got accidentally released out into the public, and something like that that sort of skips... stages of evolution. That's my phone. Sorry about that. Stages of evolution. That kind of thing can be dangerous because it might speed up how it maybe mutates. I know that's like a big chunk of stuff, but that kind of concerns me that we'll have like a zombie apocalypse or something.
Well, the end may be near. Who knows?
well, if the end's near, we're going to need a good lawyer, right? So, you have a new book out, and it's called Surviving False Accusations. And... I know that it centers primarily around kind of the family side of it with divorces and stuff, but what prompted me to ask you to come on about this was because we're seeing a lot of that in the media right now, where people's lives are being destroyed because, you know, they're saying something that maybe is not quite taken right on Twitter, and then, you know, there's mobs of people that come out, falsely accuse them of being racist and destroy their life. I don't know if what is in your book kind of pertains to that or not, but I think we should discuss it. I think we should discuss how people can rebuild when they are being accused of something they did not do.
Exactly. You know, this has actually been going on a lot more often than even after the hashtag MeToo movement. This is something that I've been dealing with for years. A lot of the times it is a stepfather who gets into a new family and he wants to discipline the children for like the first time in their lives. They don't like it, so they say stepdad touched us inappropriately, so he needs to go to jail. Like, we just want him out of the family.
Right.
And they don't really realize what their accusations are doing. And I hate to put a statistic number on these types of things. There's no statistics out there. I just know from dealing with about 50,000 cases that my firm has dealt with.
Jeez.
I would say about 15% of the accusations made are false.
Wow.
That's an alarming number.
Well, but see, that's an interesting thing because, okay, there was, what's the guy, and these don't appear to be false accusations, but there's a couple of comedians right now that are in trouble because they got a little flirty with people on the internet. And
Jimmy Kimmel, we needed to cancel him, though. I mean, with that whole Megan Fox thing, that was creepy. To say that all men sexualize 15-year-olds, that's something wrong.
Wait a minute, hold on. I'm actually new to this one. I've been watching the Jimmy Kimmel stuff, but it's been about the blackface. I didn't realize that there was something out there about, fill me in.
Okay, so he was interviewing Megan Fox, and Megan Fox said whenever she was 15, she was an extra in Bad Boys 2. Michael Bay was the director. They said, hey, she's 15 years old. She can't have a drink in her hand because they were filming a bar scene. So his response to that was, well, if she can't hold a drink, then let me put her in a Stars and Stripes bikini and stripper heels, as well as a cowboy hat, and let kind of like water fall on her, like a rainfall.
Oh, God. No.
15 years old. She was like, yeah. She was so embarrassed. She was telling Jimmy Kimmel about this. And Jimmy Kimmel basically said something to the effect of, well, I think all guys think like Michael Bay does. We just don't say it out loud, you know, because we're nice guys. And that has been unearthed. And this is the reason why I'm glad the hashtag MeToo movement came out, because we don't need stuff like this.
So that, okay, but the point that I was making going back, because I actually had not even heard about that. That's insane. The point that I was making, though, is that it's very easy for people to be accused of something that they didn't do in today's world, because we have a tendency in the media and in social media to automatically believe stuff. And in this case, there's a tape of it, right, with Jimmy Kimmel. And in the case of the blackface stuff, that's also been, that was on video. He did it on a show. So he did it on a show. So that there's tape of that. It actually happened. But there's other cases where people will be accused of stuff, maybe because they're a prominent individual and people see an opportunity, or because there's a, you know, let's go back to the Covington Catholic kids, right? Where the mainstream media essentially constructed a narrative that was completely false about these kids and what they were doing, when in fact, it was another group of people who were yelling racial epithets at those kids and other passersby. Some of the kids confronted those people. And then somebody on the outside, this Native American guy, sees what's happening, assumes that it's the white kids that are being racist to this group of African American people who happen to be the ones shouting the racist stuff, walks over, and then the media captures just the tail end of that story. The kid ends up making, I don't know what the settlement was, but he sued like CNN and the Washington Post and several major media outlets. I know he got settlements from a couple of them. But his life is forever going to be charred with that sort of moniker. There are people on the left in America that still think that that kid was being a racist, even though he wasn't. It's like, how do you survive that stuff?
Well, let me give you an example. All right. So when we were researching this book, we found that if you were a male in education, it wasn't a matter of if you were falsely accused, but a matter of when. There was this guy who was a kindergarten teacher. He had young girls himself. A girl falls down, gets mud and dirt on her knee, grass and everything. And he did what instinctually anybody would do in that situation, wipe off the dirt. There could be chiggers in there. There could be all sorts of stuff. So a mom saw that and called him a pedophile. So a whole investigation was opened up. I mean, he felt like he couldn't really even breathe while this investigation was going on for something as minuscule as that, just getting way overblown.
Right.
And so in our book, we talk about things that you cannot do anymore.
You can't hug a child that's not your own child.
Yeah, you can't even pat him on the back. And like what we're finding out is, like, as humans, we kind of need that interaction.
Yeah.
To know that we're accepted and loved and cared for, all those good things that we need. But
what you're saying is, in your book, you basically say at this point in society, if you're a man in education, it's not a matter of if, but when you get accused.
Exactly. And teaching is a thankless job. It really is. And you can't, it's not like you could sue the school for investigating you on that, even if it becomes false.
Okay, but this is totally anecdotal. This is totally anecdotal, okay? But there were songs about Hot for Teacher. And when we see in the news about inappropriate relationships between students and their teachers, what is it most of the time?
It's mostly women.
It's the hot female teacher and a boy in the class. I find that fascinating. And you never hear of, you almost never, sometimes you do, but you almost never hear of accusations about that. It's always like after the fact when the boy bragged about it, right? I mean, it's like, that's how it always comes out.
He was bragging about it. It's usually a parent who finds out after the boy bragged about it.
Or somebody gets a hold of their cell phone. I'm not trying to make the equivalent of the two, because clearly you have entirely different hormonal makeups. It's clearly inappropriate regardless of which it is. But it's a lot. How do I phrase this? I want to phrase this correctly. women and young girls are far more vulnerable, and you have to take those situations way more serious than, I think, than the opposite. And I think that's why the media sort of plays it up. But I find it interesting that that what you're saying is that for a male, they're probably going to get accused of it, even though what we see in the news is it's generally the other way around. I don't know. I find that interesting.
That is a very interesting point that you brought up. And it's amazing because I've actually had friends commit suicide based on false accusations. Wow. And it's a very sad story because the moment we get cleared, like before they have like, hey, good news. They found out that the charges were baseless. They're going to throw him out. That morning he took his own life before we even got to tell him that his life was going to get back to normal.
Wow.
And these false accusations ruin lives. And my co-author, Lawyer Kelly, she's on all sorts of social medias. You can't really open TikTok without seeing one of her videos. Mm-hmm. Very talented California divorce attorney. She made a TikTok saying, hey, false accusations ruin lives. She was dragged. Basically, people told her that they hope that she gets raped and killed just for speaking out about it. And that's kind of why we had to write this book, too. Like, we stand by the victims. Absolutely. We don't want to make it harder for them to step up and say anything. But at the same time, we also, as true feminists, want to stand up for Ben's rights, too.
Right. Well, OK, so I think I like the point you just made, is that a true feminist, and I can't speak for them since I'm a man, but a true feminist, it would seem to me, would want truth, because that's the whole point, right? I mean, truth. You don't want people to be falsely accused for the sake of a cause, which sometimes happens. Sometimes there seems as though there's this mob mentality in these false accusations that collateral damage is acceptable because it furthers the cause, right? When in fact it doesn't. It does the opposite of that, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's truth and justice. We want the right circumstance to happen after the fact.
Right.
We don't want people falsely accused. I mean, it could be something as benign as, you know, a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old refusing to put on her seatbelt. Mm-hmm. And the mom grabbing the seatbelt and physically, like, strapping the child in because safety first.
Right.
Well, that child could go and say, like, tell her teacher, my mom tried to strangle me with the seatbelt. It happens way often. And then a CPS investigation's opened up. Right. And
which is an incredible violation of your life. No, I mean, it is. I mean, can you imagine? It's like you said, with people whose lives, I think being falsely accused sometimes, being falsely accused is one of those genies that can't be fully put back in the bottle, right? Like, even mm-hmm. if it proves out that you didn't do what you were accused of doing, you know in the back of your mind that there will always be people that didn't hear the outcome.
Yeah.
Because, okay, a perfect example of this is what happened yesterday. We find out, so 15 FBI agents swarm NASCAR, Bubba Wallace's garage, and we find out that what was supposedly a noose was a rope handle to pull down the garage door that's been there for months before the garage.
9 months, yeah.
Yeah, 9 months before the garage was randomly assigned to Bubba Wallace. And, you know, I posted on Facebook yesterday. I was like, this is not a helpful situation. The media swarmed this story. NASCAR did major penance about something that, you know, they essentially falsely accused themselves, which is another phenomenon we should talk about what's going on in today's world. NASCAR essentially falsely accused themselves because they were so afraid of the online mob coming after them because tensions mm-hmm. are so high right now. And then it turns out that people are like, oh, yeah, that got put in there 9 months ago because we needed something to pull it down instead of just a straight rope. And now there's even people in the media, Don Lemon at CNN, who are still entertaining this idea. Inside Edition ran a story that was not corrected 2 hours after the FBI came out and said, hey, this wasn't actually a noose and it wasn't intended to go there. I mean, there was still media running false stories. So there's people today that are never going to look and see the corrected headline. They're just going to make this assumption about NASCAR for as long as they live. That mm-hmm. can't be put back in the bottle.
You're right. And a lot of people don't really educate themselves to hear the follow-up news article. What they do is they just hear the water cooler.
Yeah.
They don't go and research it themselves, which is very dangerous. But it's not the first time the media has screwed something up and has been subsequently sued and paid ridiculous buku money.
Right.
And they keep on doing it because I think to them, Sensationalizing it is
clicks.
Actually a huge incentive.
Yeah.
Yes.
All they need is the clicks, and it doesn't matter even if they tell a story that is false and wrong and they know it full well when they say it. They know that they can go back and cover their own ass by doing a retraction or doing a correction, mm-hmm. and they'll get clicks when they do the correction, and it won't be as many clicks as when they did the original story, but either way they win. They literally can't lose in these cases, which is part of what's wrong with the media right now, I think.
Exactly. And we're seeing the spillover results in our day-to-day life as well.
Yeah. Who should read your book?
I think anybody. I think there's a lot of useful information. My co-author, she's a divorce attorney out in California, and it is actually considered malpractice if you don't say, wink, wink, are you sure your husband didn't harm you in any way? Are you sure he wasn't abusive? Because if the client says yes, they get a windfall. And it's so easy to get a protective order. So I think anybody who cares about anyone should read it just to say, hey, like, at least I know about this and can prevent it. Because we give step by steps on how you could lower your chances of being falsely accused.
Can these principles be applied to protect you from, say, false accusations in mob swarms on social media?
Oh, you know, we didn't really think about that. We wrote this book like before.
You need to do a second
protests.
Version now.
Yeah.
How to protect yourself from the social media mob.
Right.
Because, I mean, and this isn't what I would consider to be a false accusation, but maybe a complete misunderstanding of what happened. But I'm sure you follow the story of the Washington Post outing a private citizen who, like 2 years ago, went to a party. And she was a progressive, a liberal, who was trying to make fun of Megyn Kelly back when Megyn Kelly was making light of blackface, right? So she goes as Megyn Kelly in blackface. And so it was supposed to be this ironic, like...
Sure.
Yeah, it was totally bad. No white person should ever go in blackface anywhere, no matter what their point is. But her point was not to, you know, imitate African-Americans. Her point was to malign Megyn... you know, Kelly, who was in the news for making light of blackface. And like, apparently, and I'm telling this story for people who haven't heard it, because I know you followed it, but apparently what happened was there were two people at the party who were very, very offended by this lady. They confronted her. She apparently called the host of the party and was in tears saying, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean, you know, blah, 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 and then goes on about her life. The host of the party was a cartoonist, I believe, for the Washington Post. 2 years later, these ladies want this person outed. The ladies who confronted her, the Washington Post obliges them because they probably don't want their cartoonist to be attacked, right? You had a cartoonist who had blackface at his party. So they out a private sector citizen who had been terribly sorry for what she had done and didn't mean it the way that it was taken. And she tells her employer, and her employer immediately fires her. Does she have a case?
Unfortunately, no. She exercised poor judgment 2 years ago. But of course, actually, I should say I have to read her employment contract. But a lot of times they do have some sort of morality clause. And showing up in blackface 2 years ago at a party certainly violates that. She should have known better. But I think it's how the media just doesn't do a good job educating the public.
Right.
I mean, she knew about the Megyn Kelly thing and she sensationalized it. But she didn't know that showing up in blackface, no matter what was wrong.
Right. Well, obviously she had poor judgment, but what I'm talking about here is that you have people that are now going back 2 years later attacking a private citizen who has no effect on anyone's life, really, in that sense.
Right.
What I believe happened here was the Washington Post said it's either us or her, because if we don't out her, they're going to come after our cartoonist who hosted the party. That's what I think Washington Post did. So they outed her in order to protect their own cartoonist, because remember, in all of this stuff, by association, you're guilty, right?
Mm-hmm.
So by hosting the party that someone shows up at that came in bad taste, they're now guilty if they don't out and then sacrifice her, right? I mean, this is the world we live in. This is the world we live in, and where you cannot make a mistake if it's a certain type of mistake. And yet average citizens make mistakes all the time, and now we live in a world where literally a mistake like that, because of social media, can destroy our financial career 2 years later. That's a scary situation. We need a whole book about this, Loretta.
I know, she was the sacrificial lamb in order to maintain the status quo that the rich and powerful stay rich and powerful.
Exactly.
They're
going
to screw over the little guy.
Exactly. It's easier because what can she do, right? Like you said, she probably has an employment contract that allows her employer to fire her for a quote-unquote moral mishap. I still think that some lawyer will take that case because it was 2 years old and she apologized to the host of the party for it. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So she just demonstrated that she knew. I don't know. I personally think she might have a case, but you're in this world a lot more than I am. But maybe we need a whole nother book for that. So
I think we have a series going.
So mostly this book, though, is for, you mentioned men who might work in education where it's a matter of when, not if. Is it mostly for men? Do you think men are more often falsely accused than women?
I don't know. I think it's easier to falsely accuse a man than
that?
A woman. But
why do you think that is?
I think it's because women, like you said, they might actually be a little bit more vulnerable, or at least society perceives them that way still.
Right.
But in California, you get a windfall in your divorce settlement.
Right. Well, what I was going to say is, obviously, you have the biological differences between men and women. And as a result of that, we also know the hormonal differences between men and women. And so to a certain extent, you know, it men are geared a certain way. And we know this. We know this about ourselves, and women know this about us, which makes us the usual suspect. Right. I mean, right. In a way, it makes us the usual suspect. So the point, I guess, I'm making is that I don't know. I think that men more often kind of do things worthy of being accused of, I guess is what I'm saying. Sometimes we deserve it. I mean, sometimes we've done something bad and we deserve to be called out for it. But other times, like you said, we're totally, because I feel like that the Me Too movement, while good in its goal of making sure that women feel safe in the workplace and that women are equally respected in the workplace, you know, is that's a very good thing. But I do feel like in some ways it might end up, if it's taken to the extreme, it can be harmful to women in the workplace, because now men will not want to be in a situation where they could be falsely accused, because there were so many false accusations in the Me Too movement that turned out to be nothing more than bad dates or even whole cloth, completely made up stuff. Right. And that mm-hmm. makes men afraid to be in situations where, I'm trying to figure out how to term this, but like,
yeah,
you don't want to be afraid to be in situations where men and women can work together, because the woman brings as much to the table as the man does, perhaps even more, but there's a fear to give that opportunity because there's a fear of being accused.
I think men have it so bad right now, because also if they are victimized, they are less likely to actually go forward with the police in fear that, you know, the police might turn them away or kind of make fun of them as well. You know,
right.
Like, hey, shouldn't you man up and everything? And I
right.
think that's very, very toxic. And they're also facing that as well as potential false accusations.
Right.
It's not an easy time to be a man right now.
So it's a happy medium, because you know, my entire life, I've always worked with strong professional women. My wife is a strong professional woman. I'm not intimidated by it at all. I don't even think twice about it. You know, the women that I work with on a daily basis are incredibly capable, incredibly powerful, strong women. There's no, I don't think, oh, geez, I'm working with a woman. That doesn't even cross my mind. This is my colleague. This is my partner in business. This is the person who's helping me execute what needs to be done. We work together in that way. And I also work in a business where, you know, it's probably less likely that you know, false accusations are going to come up, because just the character of the people that I work with. But not everybody has that that benefit, you know. So what is your advice? I guess, guys, read the book. Read Loretta Powers' book.
Yes. In order to protect yourself, it goes line by line on how you could eliminate those chances. But
yeah.
I think what you said is right. I mean, we're allies in this.
Yeah.
We just want to do a job and do it the best way we can. And studies have shown that businesses with half as many women as men tend to do a lot better than businesses that are just owned by a majority of men and have male workers.
Yeah.
So I think we definitely bring a lot to a table, and we don't deserve to be sexually harassed, or even those like benign comments and everything. I've had prosecutors just not want to work with me because I'm a woman, and that it hurts your soul.
Right.
Whenever it's something that, you know, I can't change my gender. I mean, I could, but it's.
But why would you want to? You're awesome right. as you are. You know what I mean? I mean, you are Loretta Powers. I am Leland Conway. You know, that's who you are. You should never feel like I need to change this because I, you know what I mean? I'm not getting the
right,
same
or
opportunity.
Less than.
Right. I mean, yeah. You are Loretta Powers. You're the awesome. You know, it's like that's you should never feel that way. Besides, I would think that women would be, you know, like uniquely suited to things like being prosecutors, because I'm gonna do a stereotypical thing here, but my wife remembers everything. It's like I can't get away with it. She's like, you said 6 months ago at 4:29 p.m. you said what? I mean, I just think it's like women make better fighter pilots, and they would make better prosecutors, in my opinion. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe the male prosecutors are intimidated. I don't know.
Maybe.
I just think you guys would make great lawyers. Must be. What else is going on in the legal world that we should keep an eye on?
Well, everything that's going on with SCOTUS. SCOTUS is in session, and they are making some moves right now that could change everything.
Yeah.
I mean, DACA, whenever Obama made that executive order, it was kind of like putting a Band-Aid over a bullet hole, mm-hmm. because we needed real immigration reform, something that we haven't had since under the Clinton administration.
Right.
And I think Trump was trying to get Congress to pass something, but I don't think it's going to be done in time in November.
Well, I found that we just had an episode with Josh Crawford, who's a kind of a constitutional expert from the Pegasus Institute. And we were talking about that particular decision, and there's some concern that the decision by the Supreme Court might force a future president to be tied to executive orders of past presidents. But as I understand it, it was a very narrow decision by the Supreme Court, in which the Supreme Court sort of took the same tack they took with the Colorado Baker case, where mm-hmm. they said, you can do this, but you did it wrong. That the Supreme Court decided, whether it's true or not, that the president was doing it more maliciously than judiciously, in the same way that the Colorado Baker, the Colorado Human Rights Commission, was actually targeting that Baker because of their religious beliefs. And it was so overwhelmingly obvious that they were specifically targeting him as opposed to just upholding the law, that the Supreme Court was like, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I haven't read the entire briefing. I'll get your thoughts on it.
Well,
but that's...
I did. I think everybody has compassion for the Dreamers. I mean, they came here through no fault of their own. Now they have work authorization, which is great. A lot of companies rely on them to
right.
do their job, and just automatically revoking that authorization. There's this legal doctrine called promissory estoppel. Basically, you promised this, and you can't just all of a sudden take it away.
Right.
Now, there's like, we detrimentally relied on this order. So you need to do certain steps in order to mitigate that detrimental reliance.
Right.
And I think only Congress could do a pathway to citizenship. And I think that's what we need.
Right. Well, the president has said multiple times, he's like, he wants a pathway to citizenship. That's the funny and ironic thing about it. Speaking of false accusations, he's been for DACA from the beginning. He just mm-hmm. wants it done right. Like you said, instead of doing the Band-Aid, he wants it done and built then. I think you're right. Most people look at this and say, look, if you were raised here in America, you don't even speak the language of the country that you originate from. You speak English. You've grown up here. Your culture is here. And you are, you know, you're working. You're going to school. That's not somebody we need to be going around going, let's deport that person, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think most Americans have come to the humane conclusion that fine, because I think about immigration this way. Like, I want strong borders. We have a right to strong borders, and there's a good reason to have strong borders. But in terms of immigration itself, me being libertarian, I don't believe that there's a limitation on what we can do economically. So I don't subscribe to, and I think actually it's an old minded head in the sand mentality to think that every time an immigrant comes here, they steal a job from a American. That's bullcrap, right? That just means right. that American doesn't want to change or doesn't want to add or grow or you know what I mean? It's like, stop it. There's jobs for everybody. We can all come here and innovate. It's just I want them to come here legally the right way, go through the right process. And I think that process should actually be easier. It should be
exactly.
easier to get here.
Because that process, if you're born in Mexico and your brother or sister is a U.S. citizen, in order for that U.S. citizen to petition for you to come over, guess how long you have to wait in line for those papers to
it's
be
like
right?
It's like 2 or 3 years, right? Because I have a friend who...
20. 20 years.
God. Okay, so I have a friend who married a... He lived in Brazil for a while.
Mm-hmm.
He married a Brazilian lady. He came back to the United States thinking, oh, I'll get her over here. Nope.
Yeah.
He's been in the United States for 5 years, going back and forth between Brazil to visit his wife. His
yeah,
wife.
Yeah, that's an immediate his, relative.
Right. And by the way, his wife is a, I think, she, I want to, I'll probably say this wrong. She's like a nurse practitioner. She's somebody we could use.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like she's,
sure.
she is a professional. She is a licensed professional in Brazil. There's no criminal history. There's no, this person needs to be here with their husband, who happens mm-hmm. to be my best friend and roommate from college. But this is insane, right? And in the meantime, you can go to where I grew up in Arizona and watch people just walk across the border.
Right.
And then we'll give them a bus ticket. We'll be like, Harry, where do you go? There's a bus ticket. It's like the whole system is completely messed up. You got me started on the immigration issue.
I could go on for
hours and days.
We need to watch it and make sure that something's done. Like,
right.
reform hasn't been done since the 90s. Can you imagine if anything hasn't been done since the 90s?
Right. Yeah. Well, if we hadn't updated styles, we'd all be wearing acid wash jeans and have foofy hair. So that would suck. What about the what was the other decision the SCOTUS made that had to do with updating basically sexual discrimination policies? It was basically saying, yeah, you can't fire somebody because they're gay. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with that ruling by the Supreme Court. And in fact, I've made the argument that the Supreme Court appears to be leaning more towards libertarian than either conservative or liberal.
Yeah.
Essentially, I can't remember. I think it was Gorsuch that wrote. Ironically, mm-hmm. it was Gorsuch that wrote the majority opinion, in which he said he was like, "Yeah," he said, "sex is interpreted this way now, and obviously, what they meant by you can't discriminate on sex means also you can't discriminate on who you love."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm totally paraphrasing what he said, but I don't think a lot of Americans were really too upset about that decision.
No, not at all. And it is a little bit of a stretch, I will say that. But it's not a complete legislation from the bench. We don't want that. Because can you imagine if this case came like back in the 60s, early 70s, and the Supreme Court ruled the other way?
Right.
Imagine what the world would be in. So
right.
we don't want them writing law. We want Congress to do that. We just want the Supreme Court to call balls and strikes.
Right.
And this one was on the line.
So in other words, back to what I was saying earlier, narrow decisions are probably better from the Supreme Court. But do you think the Supreme Court will take up a Second Amendment case?
They have been punting those.
Yeah.
They really have, like actively punting those.
Yeah, it's almost obvious that they're avoiding it.
Right.
Which in a way, I would make this case, I would say that in a way it's kind of good because there's a limiting power, a balancing power here, where liberal states might be less likely to take sweeping attempts to go after guns because there is this sort of quasi-conservative court hanging over here that's not taking anything up and not messing anything up for them right now. But if they were to do something that was a bridge too far, could cause
mm-hmm.
a bigger decision to be made that could literally reverse everything. So there's sort of this weird, uncomfortable balance between the left and right on guns right now. Plus, we're seeing liberals by the tens of thousands buying guns in recent
mm-hmm.
days, too. So that kind of changes things.
My prediction, the Supreme Court will probably hear the issue of whether or not you could take away gun rights from somebody accused of family violence.
Right. Red flag laws, which I think is a total violation of due process. And I think that it's a huge problem. It's not that I want people that have been engaged in violence or whatever, or but you got due process. I mean, if you're accused, we've just spent, 34 minutes here talking about being falsely accused. And there's been cases, the Maryland situation, where the guy ended up getting killed by the police. His, mm-hmm. I think it was his sister, called in a red flag on him and later admitted that she did it because she was mad at him, not because he was truly dangerous. And he answers, mm-hmm. He answers the door at 5 o'clock in the morning to guys banging on his door. He answers it with a gun. Struggle ensues because here you are, a private citizen who has no idea there's a red flag law pulled against you, meaning you're a mm-hmm. law-abiding citizen, and some police officers at the door saying, I need to take all your guns. And you're going, hell no.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that guy got killed.
And sometimes the police, with the no-knock warrants that I think should be outlawed, they don't even announce this is the police.
Right.
But, of course, who am I going to trust? At 5 o'clock in the morning, somebody banging in? I don't believe you. You could be lying.
Right. Yeah.
It's pretty easy to get a fake cop uniform.
We agree on no-knock raids. I think one of the things – several things that need to happen in terms of police reform nationwide in the wake of the George Floyd incident, in my opinion, are, one, no-knock raids need to go except for – in cases where there's imminent danger to someone in the household, like a kidnapping or a hostage situation.
Mm-hmm.
Or
and like collar crimes.
Right.
Because you could shred a lot of documents in that time.
I just think if it's not a violent crime and there's not imminent violence, there needs to be no knock. That you can't have the no knock. I just think that is just a...
Well, I think you should extend it to white collar crime because those guys actually do a lot of damage.
But they have guns too. They can be dangerous too. That's the thing.
Usually they don't. They have other people to hold guns.
They just adjust their glasses and their bow ties.
Right.
So
sorry about the stereotype.
No, it's okay. But I think seriously. But no, I think no-knock raids for nonviolent drug crimes is just dumb. It's stupid. I think another thing that needs to happen is it needs to be harder to be a police officer, but you should get paid more. And there should be a lot more training that is ongoing constantly where you're running scenarios about various different things. Because my fear is this whole defund the police movement is there's no way we're actually going to defund the police. I mean, 90% of Americans, the vast majority of even of African Americans who they don't want less police. They don't want police defunded. Those statistics are out there. The problem is. The strategy of this movement is working. You're going to have police leaving in droves because good mm-hmm. police are not going to, they're not going to want to stick around. It's not worth it. And the problem is you're going to have authoritarian jackwagons are going to be the only ones willing to take the risk who are going to enjoy wielding authority over people that are going to end up being our police. It's going to be a self-fulfilling philosophy, unfortunately.
Yeah. And it's going to make the income gap so much greater because the wealthy are actually going to hire
yes.
these police officers that were too good to basically protect themselves from.
Right. Yep. Ironically, there's a version of that happening in the Chaz area in Seattle yeah. where the residents band together and hired a private security firm because mm-hmm. they feel completely there's no police there. The police abandoned that section of town. And they're like, we have nothing to protect ourselves with. And there's been shootings and rapes and all kinds of things in the anarchic utopia that they created. And there's no justice for those people because how do you go in when there's no police? There's no one to investigate. You know, nothing. There will never be accountability for those crimes. So these people hired their own. And that's what's going to happen in places like Minneapolis and others where they do this. And like you said, there's going to be an even more visible haves versus have nots.
I never thought in a million years that we would see something like Chaz in our country.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah. But we are, and we're seeing it, and the idea is growing because there's a lot of people out there that I think have a very vested interest. Their goal is not justice for George Floyd, the people that are involved in mm-hmm. this kind of thing. Their goal is to tear down our entire system. And they won't stop until they get what yeah. they want. So
they're populist. We've seen this throughout history.
Yeah. Unfortunately, history repeats itself. Hey, Loretta, it's always great talking to you. Thanks for coming on. Your book is called How to Survive False Accusations. Where can people pick this up?
On Amazon.
Sweet.
Yeah.
That's...
And follow on social media, at Lawyer Kelly on everything, and Loretta_Powers. We have the links posted, and definitely check it out.
Yeah, awesome. I think it's probably very, very helpful for some people. Thanks so much. Good talking to you.
Thank you. Have
right.
a great one.
All right,
bye.
You too. Loretta Powers, she's always fun. Interesting stuff, interesting conversations always come out of that. Hey, if you like what's going on here on the podcast, keep tuning us in, keep downloading us, forward it to your friends, share it. It's a free download. All you got to do is go to Apple Podcasts, go to Google Play or the iHeartRadio app, where you can get new episodes delivered straight to your inbox, which I absolutely love. Thanks to my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills, and to Dynamics Audio Productions for the audio help on this program. And thanks to JP Web Design for their help with the website. What do we have coming up? Jeff Muldrum, the famous Bigfoot investigator and anthropologic biologist, I think I'm saying that right, from the University of Idaho. No, Idaho State University. He's going to pop on the program with us. Let's see. We've also got some other pretty big guests coming up, and Cameron Mills is going to pop on with us as well. So fun stuff coming up on the Disruption Zone. Thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway. Follow me on Twitter. It's at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption. And on Instagram, it's at Great Lelando and at The Disruption Zone. Thanks for listening.